Today's episode of Socially Democratic is presented to you by Dunn Street. Dunn Street is a campaign agency that specializes in community organizing. We only work with people that want to build power to make the world a better place, including community-based organizations, trade unions, progressive businesses, and social democratic parties across the globe. We develop community engagement strategies to win campaigns, both big and small. We train engagement staff and volunteers in the GANTS framework of leadership, organizing, and action. And we help folks craft their story through the practice of public narrative that connects people through shared values and moves them to act together. And if you want to create change in your community in 2024, then hit us up at dunstreet.com.au. Today's episode is also brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. For over 100 years, Maurice Blackburn have been extending access to justice for everyday Australians through their advocacy and campaign work. And they need your help. They have a job opportunity for a social media communicator with a flair for progressive campaigning based in either Melbourne or Brisbane in their marketing and comms team. For more information, check out mauriceblackburn.com.au/careers. And finally, today's episode is brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energize the community both online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, go to their website, swiftfoxcrm.com, to win your next campaign. Hello and welcome to another episode, a new season of Socially Democratic, your weekly centre-left politics and organising podcast out every Friday that dives into the progressive campaigns of the day and the people leading them from home and abroad. And before I introduce who we're talking to on today's episode, one, want to thank Rebecca Thistleton from the McCall Institute for stepping in for me while I was on leave the last 2 weeks. Check out the two episodes that she did, one with Channel 7's Charnel Vella and fellow McCall Institute member Ed Kavanagh. Two great episodes there. So thank you, Rebecca, so much for stepping in and letting me get a bit of a break. Great to be back. First episode for me for 2024. Might be a little bit rusty, but bear with me. And also thanks to all of our dedicated listeners who are back for another year. Great to join us for season, what was this, five, I think? Six? Can't remember. Of Socially Democratic. And we're starting this year by going over to the United States. The primary season in US politics is now upon us, both for the Democrats and for the Republicans. Obviously, the Democrats, they have a primary season, but Joe Biden will be the presumptive nominee. But in the Republican side, obviously, probably Donald Trump, forgot his name there for a moment, will most likely be the presumptive nominee. However, he's actually going through a proper contest. And we've already had the Iowa caucuses, New Hampshire primaries, and South Carolina's coming up next. And there's still a race going on. So we thought we'd get Joan A. Wartell, a good friend of ours, good friend of the show, Democratic consultant based in DC. You've heard her before. She's been on the show before to talk to us about what is going on, both on the Democratic side of the campaign and the Republican side of the campaign. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts when you're done listening. And leave us a review. And for all the updates, follow Dunn Street on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All right, let's get to today's episode. We are taping this one on a Saturday morning on the lands of the Wurundjeri people. And it's lovely to be back on home soil after being away for a while. And joining me on the line on a Friday night, no less, that's how dedicated this particular person is to this podcast. She's a Democratic consultant based in Washington, D.C. You know her. She's been on the show plenty of times. Joan A. Wartell, welcome back to Socially Democratic.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Great to be back.
I should also say that you've been doing a bit of TV lately as well. So you've gone from the fertile grassroots medium of podcasting to the big lights.
What can I say? Your girl's got range.
Yes, you certainly do. So we're very grateful that you continue to return back to your roots and stick with us for a while. That's great. Love it.
It's a pleasure to be here. Always, always, always a great time and always a great conversation.
Indeed. So same as what we normally do, let's break up the show into two parts. Let's talk about the Republicans first and then maybe the Democrats second. It's now 2024. This is a presidential election year. This is a big year, another big moment for US politics. The primaries for both parties are going on at the moment, but obviously the bigger primary is the Republican primary, and it is now underway because we've now had the Iowa caucuses, the New Hampshire primary, the Nevada caucus. We'll kind of talk about that in a minute. The US Virgin Islands had their caucus just recently as well. And coming up on the card is the South Carolina primary and then Super Tuesday. So we're really kind of getting to the make or break moment, I guess, for the Republican presidential primary contest. But for folks that are listening that haven't been paying too much attention, why don't we just do a bit of a recap? And I want to start with the first of the contest, which is the Iowa caucus, where Donald Trump was a clear winner. He got 51% of the vote. He gained 20 delegates. Ron DeSantis from Texas got 21% of the vote, gained 9 delegates. And Nikki Haley got 19% of the vote, gained 8 delegates. This was the big one for Ron DeSantis to make an impact. But Trump obviously was the clear winner. What are your takeaways from this first contest? Was there any surprises or were there things that you were like, oh, okay, that's interesting?
Well, I can say there were no surprises whatsoever, despite the fact that Republican candidates had been campaigning in these early states for months ahead of these contests. Donald Trump continues to dominate the field to the surprise of absolutely no one. Money, millions of dollars were spent by the Haley campaign, by the DeSantis campaign, to little or no effect on these primary results. And we saw that Trump came out on top because as all the polling has indicated up till this point, Republicans are standing with him. And, you know, he is going to cruise right on by till November. And I think for a lot of folks, I think that the primary contest, these early contests are really a bit of a test, a thermometer, if you will, of where is the Republican voting base, right? Is there a chance they'll trend a little more moderate in the general election? Is there a chance that they're going to fall more back in line with Trump in terms of the extremism? And so you saw with the vote share for each of the three major candidates that most Republicans are still comfortable with voting for a MAGA Republican, despite the indictments, despite his continued tango with the judicial system. People are still very much lockstep behind him. And so I think that that really says a lot about where the GOP brand is. They've really not been able to recover it. When you think about DeSantis placing, second in this contest, I think people thought, okay, maybe he's in it to win it for the long term. But then we fast forward to another contest, we see that he was not, in fact, right? And so what we saw was a pretty predictable outcome, I believe, for these early contests, especially Iowa.
The DeSantis campaign, the Iowa caucus was there. And he sort of said that he was putting everything into that particular contest to start with. Only got 21% of the vote. What went wrong? Because you think back to when DeSantis sort of first came on the national scene, he was seen as someone that was Trump light-ish, I guess. Very popular in his home state of Florida, but that just did not translate to a national level, did it? What happened in that campaign?
Well, I think you said it perfectly. He was trying to appeal to too many segments of the Republican electorate, right? He was trying to appeal to the MAGA Republicans who had already were staunchly behind Trump. He was trying to appeal to moderate Republicans, right, who were probably closer to, you know, the average Florida voter in some ways. And so he was trying to be all things to all people, right? And it didn't work, right? Because the MAGA Republicans were still standing behind Trump and they didn't And then the moderate Republicans were like, wait, are you a moderate or are you a MAGA Republican, right? And so you had this kind of dance that he was trying to do with the Republican electorate that just didn't work. It backfired. And so I think that was important. When it was beneficial for him to stand kind of close to Trump in some of those early debates, you'll remember, he kind of stood a little, tried to cozy with Trump. And then when it was important for him to distance himself, he tried to distance himself. And I don't think for many voters, Republican voters, evidently, there was enough of a clear, who is Ron DeSantis as a presidential candidate, right? That question just never was answered in those early contests. It's just an unskillful strategy, right? And so I think we saw that is why his campaign tanked so early. He had some success appealing to conservative religious voters, but some people just really saw that as like a disingenuous strategy, right? Again, trying to be all things to all people. So the coalition that Ron DeSantis needed just never coalesced. And I think that's why he was out so early.
And then we moved to the next contest, which was the New Hampshire First in the Nation primary, where Nikki Haley was then by that stage the only candidate left running against Trump, because Vivek Ramaswamy had also withdrawn, DeSantis had withdrawn. And the result there was Trump got 54% of the vote, gaining 12 delegates, and Nikki Haley got 43% of the vote, gaining 9 delegates. Just for the folks at home, this is a primary. It is different to a caucus, but also in this particular New Hampshire primary, registered independents can vote in this Republican primary. Why, maybe explain to folks what that is and why that created an opportunity for Haley to potentially do well in this particular primary.
Well, if you look at the results here, I mean, Nikki Haley performed better than expected, but not as well as she likely could have. And this sort of venue is actually really perfect for underdogs like Nikki Haley, right? Because you're able to, you know, capture kind of the unaffiliated and moderate voting blocks who has certain issues that they were most concerned about in this case. Like a lot of New Hampshire moderate voters were concerned about the economy. No real surprise there. But then, you know, you see that there were other voters who maybe were a little bit more conservative who, like, it was hard to coalesce. So it was a little difficult, I think, for her to really, again, appeal to the various segments of voters. And in a caucus versus a primary, like, you know, there's a lot of folks who can move to different candidates if they, you know, if they choose. And so it's a little bit of a small D democratic process. But at the end of the day, you still have to have a coalition of voters who at the end of that caucus process decide on you, right? And so I think, you know, that you run into the same problem at the end of the day, right? Who are voters coalescing around, and is it you? And in this case, it was not Nikki Haley, because Trump still dominated. And so even with caucus processes, it's still a contest amongst your base voters, right? And so at the end of the day, you still have to have the support to win them over. And so coalition building being, you know, the at least first or second favorite amongst those key voters, that's still your path to victory. And I think she still didn't have the support amongst the collective caucus and primary goers. And so she was still having to kind of fight her way into building a coalition of support, and she just didn't get there.
The independents are interesting because obviously in the New Hampshire primary, you know, because these independents can vote, and they're not, I mean, they are, they're by the fact of their name, they're not Republicans, they are independent, but they can weigh into either the Republican or the Democratic primary. She really needed to get a lot of independents to weigh into this Republican primary for her to be super competitive against Trump and his MAGA base. I'm wondering, what do we draw from the enthusiasm of independent voters coming out in this particular primary, and what can that tell us about what will happen in New Hampshire in the presidential election? Because if correct me if I'm wrong here, Jonah, but I think that the turnout by independents in the Republican primary wasn't as high as expected, that might be a good thing for Biden and the Democrats in November, right?
Right, because in some of the polling, you've probably heard it via the news stations, there are people who are independents who would vote for Biden if that choice came down to Biden versus Trump. So it's actually good to see that there are most Republicans and moderates aren't falling in line with Republican candidates in the primary, because that provides a more wide open field for the Biden campaign to win those folks over and become Democratic voters in the fall. So that is actually great news for the Biden campaign, that there are still folks who don't like Nikki Haley, who don't like Donald Trump to start, who don't like Nikki Haley enough for her to be an alternative for them, and are still sitting in that middle ground to say, I'm undecided. I don't like any of these Republicans voters. But we're, of course, thinking about the Republican primary. So that's essentially the choice that's before them. But when you move to a general election and they have another choice, and that's a Democratic voter, many have said that that is what they would choose. So that is great news if you're a strategist who knows that you do need to win over some of those independent voters to shore up your path to victory in November.
So later this month, we've got the next primary, which is South Carolina, which is the home state for Nikki Haley. I was going to say the nickname for South Carolina, and now it's Buddy Wells slipped me. What is the nickname for South Carolina? I'm going to test you as well. It's the North Carolina's Tar Heels. So what's South Carolina? They are the...
They're in the Palmetto State.
Yes, very good. Well done.
I only know that because my mother is a South Carolinian, born and bred. So that's one of the reasons I know that. But yes, the Palmetto State.
The Palmetto State, correct. So this is her home state. This is kind of her do or die moment, really, isn't it? Like, if she doesn't, she needs to win this state, right? Well, I mean, if you're running her campaign, what do you want to see from this particular result? What to keep this Nikki Haley momentum going?
Well, the South Carolina primary outcome is going to be embarrassing for Nikki Haley, and I really hate to see what is going to happen, because even though these early contests and Iowa, New Hampshire were must wins for her, this is absolutely a must win, right? Nothing will more quickly deflate your campaign like not being able to win your home state, a state that you've governed, right? And so I think when you look at these early contests, you can see that the trends aren't trending in her favor. And so I think that we're going to see that the MAGA Republican base that propelled Donald Trump to victory in these first two contests are going to be in full force here in support of Donald Trump. I don't think that those folks are going to break for Nikki Haley. You'll see some moderates, but you know, I think you were more likely to see more moderate support for her in those early contests, right? Like South Carolina is not known for its moderate Republican voters, right? You're moving down south now, right? You're not in the Midwest. You're not in the you're not in the New England area. You're in the deep south, right? And so I think you're going to see folks who likely, you know, voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump in the general election in 2020 are going to vote for him again in this primary contest. I don't envision that we see a big turn. But then even if she performs better than we expect her to, you know, does that keep her campaign alive? I think becomes the open question, right? Because you still got to have the money, the resources, the support to move on to those later contests. And will she is the question.
I know. And I mean, look, I'm speaking purely from a like a Schadenfreude kind of perspective. I just want the Republican primary campaign to continue for as long as it possibly can, because whilst that's happening, then Trump can't raise money for the general. So that's the only reason why I'm rooting for Nikki Haley here. Trump's currently on 63 delegates. She's on 17. And I'm wondering, like, even if he was to win South Carolina – but it would be a similar result to, say, like what happened in New Hampshire, where the delegate split is reasonably level, like a sort of a, I don't know how many delegates are available in South Carolina, but like a sort of a 55-45 split, then maybe you can make an argument that she should at least take it to Super Tuesday and test the waters across a more diverse part of the Republican electorate, right?
Right. I think that if, you know, if the result and the outcomes in South Carolina aren't humiliating for Nikki Haley, I think there's a chance she tries to push forward to these early contests. I think she'll continue to position herself as, you know, the person who can beat Donald Trump, but you've got to beat Donald Trump when you say that, right? And so that's going to ring hollow, I think, after this South Carolina contest if she's not able to have a better showing. I do think that your point about taking this forward into more diverse electorates for the later contest, I think is an important one, because I do think her showing range with a more representative part of the electorate, cross-section of the electorate in these later contests could show people that, you know, she has more general election viability than originally thought from these first contests. But again, South Carolina is also a more diverse state than the two previous contests in Iowa and New Hampshire. And so she's got to perform that well there as a litmus test in South Carolina to show that with a more diverse electorate, she can perform well.
And the other, I mean, the challenge about Super Tuesday is it tests your organizational capacity as well. And does she have enough money to be able to put folks on the ground across all of these states and be campaigning? Because I think it's on the 5th of March. So she's got less than a month.
Right.
I don't know. I would imagine right now she wouldn't be putting any money into those states right now. All that money should be, I've been reading articles that, you know, donors are coming in and, you know, anyone but Trump sort of Republicans are kicking money into her campaign. All of that needs to be going to South Carolina. You wouldn't be putting that into any of those states further down the primary calendar, correct?
Right. If you're Nikki Haley's campaign, if you're a strategist on Nikki Haley's campaign, you're saying, let's put this money into South Carolina. Let's show people that there are Republicans who are in your corner, who are supporting you, that you can win in these more diverse primary contests. And that's going to pay you dividends later on, right? The money that you're spending organizing and putting resources into South Carolina, if you are successful, that's actually going to kick up your fundraising for some of these later contests, right? But if you're not performing well there, then who's going to give you money for these later contests, right? So she's got to make some investments now that hopefully will pay dividends in these later contests where she recaptures the confidence of Republican donors that she can move forward. So if I'm sitting down with a map in a timeline of the next coming primary races, that's what I'd be doing if I was Nikki Haley's campaign.
Let's take a quick break to talk about SwiftVox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust. Lists that are up to date, absolutely. Phone banks that can change minds. Emails that drive donations and events that will energize the community online and offline. And text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftVox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. And to find out more, go to SwiftVoxCRM.com to win your next campaign. Okay, let's get back to the show. Without stating the obvious, though, we're doing here, we're trying to make an argument for potentially prolonging a Republican primary race. But let's be honest, Donald Trump's going to win, and isn't that not remarkable that the fact that he has not turned up to any of the debates, he has spent most of his time in court or playing golf. He has not been on the ground, except for maybe in the final days of leading up to a particular primary or a caucus. Like, he has been an absent candidate, and yet he is crushing this. I mean, that is unheard of. If you'd said to someone pre-Obama that if you ran a campaign like this, that you would be getting 50-55% of the vote, you'd be going, you're nuts. That doesn't exist. That can't be possible. Well, I mean, what is this? What does it say about the Republican Party?
What an anomaly. And the stories that will be written, the books that will be written about this Trump era are going to be fascinating. That a candidate who, frankly, made clear pretty early on in the debate process that he wasn't going to be on that stage, right? He's never really taken an active part of this campaign or his own campaign, but to put out some early videos. If you'll recall, he put out some early videos and send fundraising emails. That's all he's really done. That's all his campaign has really done. And that's all they frankly needed to do, because let's be clear, his reelection campaign really began the day he left office, right? And so he's maintained the level of support that he has amongst Republicans really since he's left office, right? That the numbers have shown that his support really hasn't waned despite him not being in office or on the ballot for the last few years. And so I think the reality of the matter is the brand of Republican is, the party of Republican is so synonymous with the Donald Trump brand at this point that it is hard to untangle the two.
That's incredible. Let's turn to the good guys and the Democrats. Lots to talk about. One thing I do want to kind of just address at the start, but kind of get it out of the way. In the last couple of weeks, there's been, I remember reading an article in the New York Times that examined the attitudes of both Republican voters and Republican elites, saying that they are convinced that Joe Biden will not be the candidate for the Democratic Party come November. There is reports in the last two or three days being handed down by a special counsel about questioning his age, his mental aptitude, his health, and the decisions that he's been making. And it's all starting to, I can see what's happening. It's all starting to coalesce around this idea that that President Biden won't be the candidate come November. And I just, can we just dispel these myths and say, whether you like it or not, Joe Biden will be at the top of the ticket come November, right?
Indeed. Joe Biden, President Biden, is running for a second term, and he will be a two-term president come November. And I think we all need to settle in, put this conspiracy theories to rest, and get to work reelecting this ticket. I think that the administration has been very clear, as has the Biden campaign, that Joe Biden ran for a second term to finish the job, to continue making progress in his agenda that he laid out at the beginning of his first term, and now going into his second term. And, you know, we're really wasting time with these conspiracy theories about him not running, not really running again. And it's a distraction, frankly. I think it's something that the Republicans have likely used to fearmonger voters into not voting for Joe Biden, because it's ultimately a vote for Kamala Harris, all that nonsense. It's really nothing more than that. Joe Biden has one of the most significant records and experience, levels of experience in government of any politician in our recent history. And, you know, he has been delivering on behalf of the American people. I do think that as the administration continues to get that message out, we see President Biden on the campaign trail as we have. My hope is that we can finally put these conspiracy theories to rest.
As Killer Mike said on the Bill Maher show the other day, don't vote the person, vote the policies. And yeah, the track record of Biden over, I mean, I think he said it himself in that press conference the other night. The things that this administration has been able to achieve since the election has been remarkable. I mean, it's been a great program of work. And I'm looking at the economic numbers now. They continue to improve. Are we starting to see that translate into polling numbers for the Biden campaign?
Well, you're right. The most recent jobs report that came out showing that the economy is strong and the economy is growing, I think is important. If I'm the Biden campaign, I'm riding around with a megaphone, making sure the American people know that. Mm. I think that messaging is going to be critically important to continue to engage voters and remind them that the Biden campaign and the Biden administration is working on the behalf of the American people. I think that's going to be important. I think that one thing that's continues to be important in this campaign is messaging, helping the American people to understand what the administration's done for them and how, if reelected, the administration can finish the job. That has always been the goal of the message. It's always been what the American people have needed to hear. How has the work that the administration's done over the past few years improved their quality of life, and how can we continue to do so in the next term? That's the job. That's the message. And we'll continue to spread that message to as many folks as need to hear it. I think there's going to need to be a lot of messengers in these local communities, elected officials, people who are allies and surrogates for the Biden campaign that are going to need to share that message so that the Biden team are not the only messengers here. But that's at the core, the winning strategy, that message.
The issue or the crisis and the conflict that's going on in the Middle East, I'm not sure if we talked about this last time we were on the pod, but there's a concern there that the part of the Biden coalition, which is young people, are not going to turn out to vote in November because of the United States' involvement in the conflict that is going on right now in the Middle East. Biden visited Michigan just recently. I'm not sure if he actually went to Dearborn, but obviously that's a large Arab American community there. Michigan is such a critical battleground state. Obviously, the fact that the president went to Michigan tells me that there is some level of concern. What's your thoughts on that, holding that coalition? Or is it a case that maybe a lot of these people who are angry and outspoken probably don't vote anyway? I always want to get your sort of read on this.
Well, the president's campaigning in Michigan because it's a battleground state, right? And so I think it's important to know that regardless of what is happening in the world, regardless of the status of this conflict, he should be in Michigan because there are key voters there that we need to turn out to win. I think it's important when the president is on the campaign trail, when the vice president's on the campaign trail, to hear and to listen to the concerns that folks have with the U.S.'s relationship and support of Israel. I think there is no way to win over those voters if you're not listening for anybody who said, I will stay home. You need to understand what their concerns are, what their challenges are, hear them out. It's not to say that there's going to be an easy, fast solutions to how this conflict's unfolding, but it is to say that we have to hear those voters out and we have to make sure that they feel heard. That's incredibly important. That said, I think that the handling of this conflict, the U.S. support of Israel, whether you know, folks in SAGE agree or disagree with that, I think you take that alongside the collective accomplishments of the administration and what they've been able to do in the lives of everyday Americans and everyday Americans who live in Michigan, who live in Pennsylvania and Georgia. I think that the alternative is clear there. And so I do think that alongside listening, empathizing, and understanding where folks' concerns are, I think there's a second part of that message, which is the Biden administration has still been working on your behalf to make your quality of life better. And then you also can contrast it with Donald Trump's record, Donald Trump and what his policies are pertaining to the Middle East, right? And that's another clear contrast. So I think it's about listening, empathizing. I don't think you win young people or voters who are concerned about this issue. I don't think you win them over without first listening and understanding where their concerns are. But then I think you go to the second part of the conversation, which is the president has been working on your behalf to do all of the things that they've accomplished, and their work is not finished. So I think that's the conversation we need to be having in all of these states.
I wonder how much impact it would have if Biden is able to seek some kind of peaceful resolution to what's going on in the Middle East right now, because clearly it is from a foreign policy perspective, he clearly is prioritizing this. Like Blinken's flown over to the Middle East I'd hate to see what his frequent flyer points is right now, because it would be huge. He's over there right now again. They're trying to broker a peace deal or a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. If he is able to somehow negotiate an incredibly protracted, complex conflict prior to November, do you think that that puts that issue to bed? Or do you think that he's burned that relationship with that young voter bloc?
Well, you're right that this issue is very complex and quite nuanced. I do believe that the Biden administration continuing to work to bring resolution gains favorability or creates favorability with the groups of voters that are most concerned about the handling of this conflict. So I'd say that the Biden administration's continued work on this is a plus. I think voters will recognize that, even if they don't necessarily feel that the initial handling was great or that the current resolution or potential resolution is favorable in their opinion. I do think that voters are going to appreciate the continued work that the administration is doing to bring resolution. So yes, I believe that will garner some favorability in the eyes of those key voters.
The issue of immigration has been another issue that's sort of popped up. Well, hasn't popped up. It's been going for quite some time, but it's coming to a sort of a crescendo because obviously there's a debate in the Congress at the moment. I'm just finding this interesting because normally you would think for a left-wing party, immigration can be a bit of a third rail issue that can hurt you. Yet the Republicans in the House have, pardon my French, but fucked this up so badly that I actually think this is actually going to become a positive for the Democrats. I just want to get your take on what's happened in Congress this week, just for the folks who haven't been reading the front page of the New York Times, what's been happening this week in terms of this debate about immigration, and how have you seen how both the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress have handled this debate and this trying to pass this piece of legislation through to get some sort of solution to what's going on at the border and with Mexico?
Yeah, this one is tough. You know, the attempts at a bipartisan bill have, you know, for the Republicans to say that it's dead on arrival is quite frustrating because, one, you know, this bill has aid for Ukraine and also has aid for Israel there as well. So let's understand that this is broader than just the border security. But, you know, there were provisions in this most recent bill that, you know, that Congress asked for, that the House asked for, and those provisions were considered and adopted and adapted in some ways, and yet they still said the bill was on arrival. So I think you see more of this obstructionist politics where folks say, let's get to work on these key issues. Folks say we need to address the border, and yet addressing the border is not actually, their actions say otherwise, right? Their actions say, we want to continue to use this as a political football and talking point instead of actually getting something done. And Donald Trump has even signaled, and I think he maybe even outright said, that he doesn't want Congress to bring any real resolution to this until he's president again. So now you have the leader of the Republican Party essentially saying that he doesn't want to bring resolution. So that's what we're up against here, right? A party that's saying we need to fix, you know, we need to address what's happening in the border. The Senate being able to bring forth a bill that does just that. If you look in the bill, there's you know, addressing asylum, there's addressing surges, there's addressing all kinds of pieces of the crisis that would actually mitigate some of the challenges. And yet you see Republicans saying, oh, well, this is dead on arrival in the House. It doesn't go far enough. It doesn't do this. Well, where's the conversation? Where's the negotiation? Where is the bipartisanship, right? And so, you know, the administration kind of running into a wall in Congress, I think is evidence of the fact that Republicans in the House say they want to get things done, but really just want to keep playing partisan football with the border with border security in this country.
And I think it's exposing the divisions within the Republican congressional caucus, because there are Republicans who are saying, no, I genuinely want to get resolution to this issue. I actually want this to pass, where there are other ones going, no, we need to drag this out for as long as we possibly can. Can this overt transparency hurt the Republicans, do you think, in their local districts? Like, does it continue to reaffirm this view that some Americans have that Washington is dysfunctional, but the fact that the Republicans are running the show in Congress, that they are to blame for the dysfunction, so therefore it can impact in their House races come November?
Yes, I think that the Biden administration needs to make clear where they've been working to take action to address some of our major challenges in this country and have been essentially just stopped in their tracks by an uncooperative Congress, especially in the last few years of Congress we've seen since Republicans took control, absolutely virtually nothing has gotten done. And so I think that if I'm on the campaign trail, I'm drawing the contrast between the administration's agenda, what they set forth to do for the American people, and the obstructionism of Congress that has not allowed them to do a lot of what they've sought out to do. I think it's important to understand that that part of creating change and passing the kind of laws that are going to change the reality of American people's day-to-day lives does require a cooperation from Congress, right? President Biden is not like Trump, who is threatened to be a dictator. He actually does have to work with people to get things done. And so the reality of the matter is, where that's been a hindrance or that's hampered the administration from making progress, I think they need to call that out. I don't think they need to take full ownership of that, because they are at this point on the campaign trail some of the most accountable to the American people for the things they've not been able to do.
Between now and, say, the Democratic National Convention, which is normally in sort of July, August, what is the focus for both the Biden administration and the Democratic campaign? Because they've got this clear run, right? What are you doing strategically to get yourself ready for the fall election?
Organizing. And you know, I'm a big organizing evangelist.
That's why I have you on the show. That's literally the reason why I have you on the show.
I talk about organizing every single place that I go. I think you've seen in recent weeks that the Biden campaign has made announcements about the infrastructure and the state leadership that they're hiring in the states, beginning to scale their programs in key battleground states like Georgia, like North Carolina, like Pennsylvania. And those hires and those announcements are critical because that signals the beginning of really robust state-based programs, right? Talking to voters, door-to-door canvassing, other communications strategies that are going to reach key voters who are going to be critical in this election. And if I'm the Biden campaign, I'm focusing my energies in these states. I'm focusing my energy on making sure that voters are engaged. We're having early conversations with voters who may be considering not voting in this election, that we're getting multiple touches to those voters, whether it's via phones and phone banking, whether it's via in-person door-to-door canvassing, whatever the means and methods of reaching these voters, I'm making sure if I'm the Biden campaign that these voters are being reached early and are being engaged. I think that's going to be where you're going to see the majority of this spring, and especially going into summer, the field force for the campaign is going to scale and we're going to see much more voter engagement. I think they've done a lot early to try and engage voters through ads and through other touches. And now it is time, now that we're in 2024, for them to build and scale their state-based programs. And I think you're going to see that happening here in the coming weeks and months.
And I'm assuming it's going to look different to, say, 2020. I mean, we were still very much in COVID. I have to double-check that then. Yeah, we were. So the Biden campaign back then, there was a reluctance to do particular door-to-door canvassing. And so the field operation did look a lot different. This time around, he's no primary. He's got a clear run. I'm assuming, right, there's going to be a lot of investment this time around from the Biden campaign in a robust field program.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In 2020, we had, the COVID-19 pandemic made it very challenging to talk to voters in person. And despite that, the Biden and the campaign did what they could to talk to, reach, mobilize as many voters as possible. But it was challenging, right? There were safety precautions that we had to take in order to not put staff at risk, not put volunteers at risk, and not put voters at risk, right? And despite that, you see that the resilience of the American people is to turn out and participate in their democracy. And so I look to 2024, understanding that we're going to return to much of the traditional in-person organizing that prior to COVID-19 that we saw Democrats undertake. And frankly, what we're known for is doing door-to-door, person-to-person, community-based organizing and outreach. And I believe that we're going to return to that in 2024.
Fantastic. Janae, as always, thank you so much for coming on the show. I don't want to take up too much more of your Friday night. I know you've got a very, very packed social schedule ahead this evening.
There's only spreadsheets and memos in my future.
Well, we love you coming on the show anyway. We look forward to talking to you throughout the rest of 2024 as we lead up to this really, really important presidential election. And I say that because we said that about the last one and I thought we were done with the kind of make or break sort of elections, but here we are 4 years later, the same contest.
Here we are, waving democracy once again.
Oh, I know, but we always appreciate your insights. So we look forward to talking to you soon.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Socially Democratic. Did you like the podcast? Hit the follow or subscribe button and be sure to leave a review on Apple Podcast or Podchaser. And to get all the latest on Socially Democratic, follow Dun Street on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we'll see you next Friday. Socially Democratic was brought to you by Maurice Blackburn Lawyers. Maurice Blackburn Lawyers have spent more than a century paving the hard path to justice for everyday Australians. They've helped over 500,000 Australians turn their situation around, and they know how the system works. Their experience and skills means you'll get the best results possible. Find out more on their website, morrisblackburn.com.au. Maurice Blackburn, experience you can count on. Socially Democratic was brought to you by SwiftFox. Every moment on a campaign matters. You need the tools that you can trust, lists that are up to date, phone banks that can change minds, emails that drive donations, events that will energize the community online and offline, and text blasts that distill your message perfectly. SwiftFox CRM is made for campaigners by campaigners. To find out more, go to swiftfoxcrm.com to win your next campaign.